The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is actually Sam Mall. If you recall, I hosted last week's show from New York City while Brett King was in Budapest. Today, Brett is actually in Odessa in the Ukraine, and I'm in Columbus, Georgia. So if that doesn't really just give you the picture of our lives, nothing really will. We're really excited for today's show. There's only one quick conference announcement, and that's Next Money, which was formerly Next Bank. They'll kick off the FinTech Week in New York City on September 7th. I'll be there. Brett will be there. The whole FinTech gang will be there. And Breaking Banks will actually be on stage. So make sure you sign up for that. It's really going to be a wonderful conference. Go to breakingbanks.com and sign up for our newsletter to make sure you don't miss any deals through the show and podcast extras. In the news today, we'll get to this really quickly, probably something really important, and this is just for Brett. Rihanna unleashed her cosmic video for Sledgehammer, which confirmed that she's a Star Trek fan. Brett,
the new trailer has her song as the backing music. So I'm getting pretty excited about the new Star Trek movie.
So we had to get that out of the way for everybody because that is important. Yeah. But probably the more interesting story is around Brexit. And really, is there any other news in the fintech community? We were talking about this last week. On last week's show, if you recall, we had Simon Taylor from the UK, the blockchain guru that he is. And at the time, the voting was in full swing. And we were actually talking about how there was a tremendous rainstorm in the UK, how trains were being delayed. Would it have any impact on the voting? I actually, flying back home,
it did.
Well, it's a fascinating result. I was actually went through a 12-hour delay at JFK. So I was able to watch Brexit unfold in front of me on Twitter, and the reactions were incredible. I think I remember when Simon actually woke up in the morning and saw the results, I can't actually say what he said. FCC won't allow us. But, at the time, I think the odds are still about 80% for Remain. So as of this morning, and you really, if this was a movie, nobody would buy the script. They wouldn't believe it. So as of this morning, Boris Johnson, the former mayor of London, a former guest on this show, announced that he will not be seeking the Conservatives' leadership position, which I guess by default means he's not going after the Prime Minister position, which I find shocking.
Well, he'd have to run as an independent, wouldn't he?
Which, it's not going to happen.
Well, when was the last time the UK, had an independent Prime Minister? I don't think ever.
I know. It's just, again, you can't make this up. So we put together a wonderful panel to talk about this in depth. All that are based in London right now, with the exception of Brett. So we know that Brett is in the Ukraine right now. So Brett is originally from Australia. You're our world traveler, Brett. But then we have, and let's make sure we have everybody on the phone, we have Lita Agliptis, who's a director with Sapient. Lita, do we have you on the call?
Yes, you do. Hi, everyone.
Hello. And Lita, you're originally from Athens, Greece, correct?
That's correct, although I have been living in England for 19 years now, so this is a very emotional week for me, as you can imagine.
I can imagine.
The Kanaskala.
Poligala. Unexpected, as always.
Well, when you grow up in Melbourne, you've got to learn some functional Greek,
That's very true.
Well, then also on the call, we have Duana Blomstrom. Duana?
Yes, that was all Greek to me, I have to say.
Oh, <God. laughs> she's been waiting for that. And Duana, you're originally from Romania, correct?
Right, I'm half Romanian, half American, so I got a lot of skin in the game, and my child is half Swedish, so yes.
And then also we have Devi Mohan. Devi?
Hi, everyone. Hi, Sam.
Hi, and Devi, originally from India, one of our favorite fintech bloggers and speakers. Duana is actually, if you know anything about emotional experience, I think she actually has that trademarked. That would be Duana. So I wasn't joking when I said we have a global panel. So, and Brett, I think this is really fitting. We're talking about Brexit. Immigration was obviously part of the argument with the vote. So here we have three very successful individuals in the fintech space that are working in the UK who all come throughout Europe and Asia, and in your case, Oceania. Brett, because you spend more than enough time in the UK to qualify you.
I am a UK citizen also, dual citizenship with UK and Australia, so I have a stake in the game.
For now you are.
Good point. So why don't we start here? And actually, all three women on the phone have written a wonderful point of view on this for the FemTech Leader site that I helped set up along with Gila Boskovich. Each of you have given a wonderful write-up for this, but I'd like to get your take on it. And Lita, I'll start with you. I mean, what do you see as the immediate impacts of the vote? Specifically for FinTech, let's stay within that space.
Absolutely. So I'd say that the first two themes that we're feeling already, I'm not talking medium term, are uncertainty. And it's such a truism that markets don't like uncertainty and it becomes self-fulfilling. It is sadly true for the way the trading goes. But it is also true in terms of how the spending goes. We have seen a lockdown in all discretionary spending. All in-flight budget negotiations of all sizes have been slowed down to a painful pace that, if you're on the outside, looks a lot like a halt. Now, from an institutional perspective, that makes perfect sense. But if you're a startup that had spent the last 8 to 10 months in painful negotiations to get a POC or a contract off the ground, the timelines stretching now ahead of you are difficult. That's one thing that we're already seeing. The second theme is that the atmosphere in London is absolutely grim at the moment. There have been fundamental changes to how the city feels. People have started talking about leaving, and within 24 hours of the vote, very interesting positioning statements have come out from a variety of other aspiring hubs. As we all know, ecosystems are nurtured, and there are quite a few parameters that can be actively helped by big players and governments, and I expect we'll see quite a lot more positioning in the weeks to come.
Well, I have to call out two specific pieces that were written, blog posts, one by Chris Skinner. And Chris actually detailed, I believe, 7 different outcomes we could see from Brexit. 7. And I believe that was the right number. And I know Chris will correct me on Twitter if I was wrong. Also, Simon Taylor. Simon did a fantastic job of outlining several outcomes that we could see. One of them is interesting. And Lita, you had mentioned it. It's, you know, there's such a strong number of EU citizens working in the fintech space, specifically within London, and there's the potential of seeing that change. Duana, you jokingly mentioned that. I mean, what do you see happening, say, in the next, well, I'll go with 2 years, because if Article 59 is actually instituted, you have the UK has, what, 2 years to actually set up all the regulations and laws to
move
out of
this? There's got to be the Act of Parliament to trigger Article 50. So we'll,
right, so it can't, it's longer than 2, but it's still around there, yeah.
So what do you think, Duana? Are you building a chateau back in Romania? Or?
You know, I'll start you off with a little short story that I just thought about today as I was preparing for the show. A couple of days ago, right after the Brexit vote, we were sitting around the breakfast table, myself, my 5.5-year-old, and our nanny, and the nanny is from Romania. So, so the child just casually asks, "So, what is everybody scared of?" And I promptly answer Brexit, mainly for the hilarity for our nanny. And she says, he says, "What was that? Is that Brexit?" I'm like, "Never you mind what it is, but it's just a bad thing." And then he says, trying to bring it back to what's important to him, "No, but is it something that keeps you up at night or you're having bad dreams about?" Because he's just trying to kind of bring it back to ghosts, which is his latest obsession. So I'm like, "No, seriously, it is keeping me up at night," and it is. And that's not because myself as a European citizen or my husband as a Swedish citizen are going to get deported. I don't actually really honestly believe that's the case. I think Britain is going to at most be smart about their politics in terms of allowing skilled immigrants to stay. I hope so, otherwise that would be just ridiculous. But what I am afraid of, in honesty, is the idea that my 5.5-year-old, who doesn't even understand color, would have to be faced with repercussions in the street or at school from people who themselves don't understand color or nationality, but have heard mom and dad that everyone who's not English should go home. That's just scary. That is paralyzingly scary to me. And I think Devi, who has a child who is actually the exact same age, actually our children are friends, can attest to this being really a scary prospect.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the UK, and I think some of our listeners know I lived in York for about 5 years working for TSIS, so I consider it my home away from home. The UK is really London and then the rest of the country. Similar to New York State is New York City and then the rest of New York.
And I have a quick one about this. I'm sorry to interrupt everyone. I know I do that a lot, but just a really quick one and then I'll shut up. When I moved,
I've never heard you do that before.
No, never. This is my first time. I'm just throwing it out. So when I moved to the UK, was to start Manigas office here as a fintech company moving to the UK, because I was in love with all things British, right? But what I said over and over, even in my piece, and now to my friends, is I think I moved to London, not necessarily the United Kingdom, which is, as you say, a bit different.
Well, I think, I'd like to go to Devi, because Devi, for those that haven't read her stuff or seen her speak, Devi, you're the voice of reason. You're the calm one, in my opinion. So from your point of view, do we think that London is going to take a hit as the fintech capital or one of the top three? I've read that we'll see Berlin, Frankfurt, Paris, which I find hard to believe if you've ever tried to work in France. Do you see those actually stepping up or taking over?
Yeah, it's interesting because even Paris, so Paris, Frankfurt, and Berlin, a lot of the banks from London thinking about moving at least part of the operations into these cities. And I hear that some of the bankers have been asked to, announce their passports so they can be put into the EU if needed. It's a really worrying development because London is one of the most multicultural, diverse cities in the world. And the strength of London is that it is at the center of not just Europe, but Middle East, Africa, and Asia. And the reason it's such a large fintech hub and has been at the center of innovation is precisely because of that, the kind of diversity of the people we have. And if those people are looking to move out, it is a very unfortunate development.
There's also the key issue that funding, venture capital funding is going to be uncertain for London fintech startups until there's some clarity. Because, Pascal Bouvier, did a great piece on this as well, Sam, in his Finiculture blog post. But, one of the points he makes is that, if you're a fintech startup in London, one of the you know, certainly one of the things in your business plan is access to EU market, and the fact you can get an, you know, you can get a single license in the UK, you can set up a presence there, get funding in the UK, and use that as a launch pad for a European Union. So there's a lot of fintechs right now, I'm sure, who are rewriting their business plans to sort of try and figure out how to get around this. And some of them, he say, will move to Dublin, Frankfurt, Luxembourg, Paris, you know, other places to sort of keep that value going. At best case, there's going to be a pause in VC funding for fintechs.
Yeah, I would agree. Uncertainty, and Lita, you started with that. Uncertainty is probably one of the worst things for the financial market. And we've seen...
We can absolutely see a slowdown in funding. I agree with that 100%. We'll see also a slowdown in the discretionary spend that has funded and powered the POCs and the little experiments here and there that have kept a lot of the companies alive. And the fear I have is of the knock-on effect that will have everything to do with limited resources and an unsettled headspace and very little to do with the actual process of exiting. Sam, you're absolutely right. The process will take 2 years from when Article 50 is invoked. That hasn't even started. And yet we see the combination of uncertainty around funding and projects and the unhappy emotion that Dwayne captured extremely powerfully having a very deleterious impact on how people are thinking, how people are planning. And I suspect that we will see a general slowdown in the whole ecosystem magic that London has brought together. And realistically, all of us, but even more poignantly, small companies, you have to pay the bills. So how many months can you afford to give a hiatus before, as a small company, you have to start thinking very actively about pursuing some revenue?
Not 2 years. Not for exactly. 2 years. You can't wait that long.
Well, you know what I find amazing from a fintech standpoint? All of us are on the speaking circuit. And when we talk about innovation, when we talk about banking, we stress culture, we stress diversity. And yet here we are talking about a vote where there was an underlying current around immigration, around diversity, around culture and losing culture. And Debbie, I know I find it interesting. Here in the United States, we have a circus going on. I think that was the word I used last week. In our own political system, and we see some of this concept of isolationism and America first. We've heard that terminology before. And yet in London, and I'm going to isolate London a little bit here, you have a Muslim mayor who was at the gay pride parade telling everyone how...
May I add?
Thank you so much. If there was ever a picture...
Wow.
Well, they had a picture of him with a... Yeah, well, I mean, it was a picture with him with a Catholic priest, archbishop, and a rabbi talking. And, you know, if you showed that picture to quite a few folks in the U.S., one, they'd have no idea who the guy was. If you told them he was the Muslim mayor of London, they would say, well, of course, the Sharia law is going to be put into effect. So it's this lack of knowledge, which can be dangerous also. If you were to bet...
But you know, there has been a real uptick, Sam, in, you know, I mean, if you look even anecdotally, but, you know, you've seen videos posted and things like that, mm-hmm. and there was this really distressing call that I saw on this radio show of this German woman who'd lived in, you know, she'd been married to someone in Britain, and all her neighbors were telling her she's got to leave now and things like this. She'd been living there for 45 years or something. And, you know, there was this thing on the tram the other day. And so all the nutters have come out, you know, based on this, the fact that the Brexit was made a lot about immigration by the populist, you know, politicians trying to capture that spirit. We see the same in the US with Trump. But, you know, I don't know if you – did you see my tweet about, you know, my theory behind this in terms of readiness on, you know, if you're not ready to deal with immigrants taking your jobs, then, you know, you're going to find it even tougher when robots start coming to take your jobs. So I think we've got some big issues we're going to have to deal with. And globalization and regionalization and things like that, you know, part of this pressure is part of this shift. Economic balance, there's going to be some global uncertainty that Brexit has given voice to, and I think it maybe it's going to take us 10, 20 years to solve some of the big picture issues around this, but stopping immigrants from coming into country isn't actually going to likely be a core strategy.
Well, we have Ron Shevlin is actually, and I'd be curious if everybody's ask or opinion on this. Ron asked, is there any, what do you think the odds are of the referendum being, you know, voted down and an impact there? Duana, start with you. What do you think?
Not a chance in hell, sadly.
Summed up succinctly, and I would tend to agree with that. Lita, what do you think? That's all right. Lita, what do you think? What do you think about the referendum actually not going through?
My heart wants to disagree with Duana. I think that even if there are people within the dominant parties that would like to disregard it, which is actually perfectly legally possible, I don't think that the European community will let them. It has been a very in-your-face campaign, and certain things will have to run their course. I also think that if some miracle happens and the whole situation goes full circle and resolves itself in a way that looks quite a lot like status quo ante, from a cultural perspective, a political perspective, and an economic perspective, we will have taken a beating. So actually, if the question was, can we stem this disaster, it will need to be a very active process, and ignoring the referendum will be a very passive process. So even if it does happen, it won't give us the results.
But Debbie, I'd be curious, is there a lesson in this for fintech companies? After every major event, there's always a write-up, our five lessons from, and I hate those. But if you were to look at this, would you say there is something to learn from this and to apply?
Yeah, this is a black swan event, literally. I mean, it's something that no one expected. And on Friday morning, I mean, you should have seen the faces of people on London transport system. So it's definitely completely unexpected. I think the lesson is be prepared for anything that might happen. And I think the second lesson is we need to look at short-term things. So I'll give you an example of an African insurtech startup I met while visiting in Africa. And such a great company. They got into one of the leading accelerator programs in London. They applied for a visa. They couldn't get the visa, and they couldn't come to London on time. So that's a very tactical thing that happened. They missed out on a great opportunity for funding because of a visa issue. And if that were to happen in the EU, it would be completely disastrous. So I think the next lesson really is to understand short-term implications, especially for fintech, and say these are the reasons why EU citizens would need a visa or kind of have an immigration policy to come into London, and what can we do to address that while the negotiations are taking place. And that's a serious issue, because we are going to miss out on talent. We are going to miss out on some great startups coming into London if that's not resolved.
Well, Brett, we've got about 2 minutes left, and you know the show does have your name associated with it for some odd reason. So I'm going to give you the last statement here. Why don't you you fill us in on what your take is going to be?
So, you know, we do need an active parliament to resolve this. And, Boris, before he stepped out of the leadership challenge today, he was backing away as much as he could on issues of immigration and things like that. But for this to have some validity, then the UK is going to have to get some sort of trade concession and a modified deal with the EU. Whether they retain some sort of special relationship with the EU out of this or get some concessions, you know, the fact is the UK is still in Europe, even if they're not going to be in the EU, and they have to have some sort of operational trade relationship. So we're not talking about them, completely exiting from Europe. We're talking about them exiting from the EU political and economic, and trade situation somehow. But I already see a lot of backpedaling from the earlier rhetoric. So I expect we're going to see a whole lot of compromises. But as I can't remember who said it earlier, but the EU, is probably Duane, the EU guys, they don't want Britain back in now. There's a bit of pride here as well. So it's not going to go back to the way it was. And that's the key problem here, because this represents ongoing economic uncertainty. And until this fleshes out, we know where it sits. And, you know, I put it this way, I wouldn't want to have Moving based in London right now, you know, as our headquarters, because I would say that this would affect future funding rounds, it would affect our opportunity for growth, it would affect our prospects for, you know, activities broader across the European, you know, region. I'm, as far as the fintech community goes, those guys who listen and participate in us, you know, they're going to be hurting right now. And, I don't know, guys, move to New York maybe.
Well, I want to thank all three of our guests from London for being on the call. Thank you so much, Brett. Thank you. One last note. Take a look at the write-ups that both Duane, Lita, and Debbie have done on fintech leaders. We have put those out on Twitter. I'd also think it's interesting that in the next 6 months, we could have the potential of a woman president in the U.S., a woman prime minister in the U.K., and a woman leading Germany. So we'll get off of that point, move on real quick. And we'd like to thank everybody. We're about to go to a break. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Temenos. Temenos is on the forefront of creating bank systems to increase financial inclusion. Please go to www.temenos.com, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
Consult Hyperion is a boutique payments consultancy based in New York and London, which helps clients deal with the rapid changes happening in the payment space. We deal with EMV optimization, helping issuers, acquirers, and merchants deliver value from their EMV investments. We help with the technical challenges involved in the digital transformation of payments through tokenization and mobile devices, and with the business cases behind the development of future payment technologies such as the blockchain and instant payments. Come and find out more at www.chyp.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everybody, to the show. Again, this is Sam Mall. I'm live here in beautiful Columbus, Georgia. And on the phone up in New York, we have Ian Carr. Ian is a reporter with Quartz who talks about Tech, fintech, blockchain has been a frequent guest on the show, and it's been, what, at least 5 days since we've seen each other and chatted?
I know. It's been too long, my friend. We've got to hang out again.
It has. I've told Ian. Yeah, I've told you multiple times. I'm just going to adopt you, you know, bring you home. And I need an older son.
Younger, which is embarrassing.
Well, Ian definitely has a pulse on the fintech scene. And what I like about Ian as a writer when it comes to fintech is he really does understand what he's writing about, which is incredibly rare these days. And he's had three very good write-ups in courts. And I'd like to kind of touch on each of those, Ian, if you don't mind. The latest one you wrote was actually titled PayPal is Warming Up to Bitcoin. Can you kind of give us a little bit of an idea of exactly what you're referring to there?
Yeah, and I'd be happy to. So Coinbase, which is one of the bigger Bitcoin exchanges, just added functionality where you can sell your Bitcoin, right, and get paid directly into your PayPal account. And that's just one of the little ways that PayPal has been slowly warming up to Bitcoin, really. They had in late December, they had a private hackathon with Coinbase, Chain, and a couple other Bitcoin companies, just trying to figure out where they essentially said, you know, here's what we do. You guys know our business. Let's figure out ways that we can integrate Bitcoin and blockchain into it. And I think from a competitive standpoint, they've been filing patents as well. Essentially, they have a Bitcoin wallet patent was published recently. And I think it really stems to PayPal's focus on a competitive level. The idea behind PayPal adopting Bitcoin is actually pretty interesting because as a tech company, they can do it and they can say, you know, they're very innovative on the tech side. As a finance company, they can say they're doing this where no other big bank and no other big financial institutions are rolling out big Bitcoin tests. Bitcoin could be a way that PayPal kind of breaks out of the breaks away from the incumbents in both the finance and tech space and kind of establish themselves as a kind of a very forward-thinking alternative.
Isn't it funny? I love the word you just used, incumbent. So we're talking about PayPal, we're talking about incumbents, and you know it's interesting because PayPal is really that first fintech unicorn, that first fintech company, or one of the first that really made it, right? That proved that you can come in and disrupt, and it's almost as if they're coming full circle now, and in order to get back into the game, if you will, or to take an advantage, looking at Bitcoin makes sense. I would agree with you.
Yeah, and I think it's actually a really smart move. I mean, you see Apple Pay with their mobile web browser functionality now that they'll be rolling out in the fall. That's a direct threat to PayPal's business, and the idea behind that, you know, is pretty clear. They want to make it easier. Apple's not in it to make money off of desktop payments. They're just trying to get people to spend money on the website and have Apple's brand be first and foremost when you're thinking about buying something. So that's a real big threat for PayPal in the short term. And separating from Apple by focusing on maybe more financial products, maybe, you know, leveraging Bitcoin and blockchain for cheaper alternatives, like let's say remittance, for instance. They do own Zoom. Bitcoin is a really easy way to move money across borders and do it in a very cost-efficient way. So that's clearly one area that they can definitely get into.
Yeah, you've covered two of the other articles I definitely want to talk about. Let's stick with Bitcoin just a little bit. And by the way, Coinbase, you know, you got to love something that Mark and Dreesen has put so much money into. And
Sure.
It's kind of hard to knock. Where I'm not one to argue with Mr. Mark there on Bitcoin.
You want to chat more about that?
It's interesting, right? We're looking at the British pound, British sterling, taking all kind of hits. And I saw a fascinating tweet, made me laugh. It was, yeah, look at, you know, there's Bitcoin is horrible. Look at all its price fluctuation. Oh crap! Look at the pound. If I look at Bitcoin today, I think it's up around 670 is the dollar mm-hmm. price. You wrote a great write-up on the Bitcoin halving event, which happens July 9th. Can you expand on that, if you don't mind?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's actually a pretty significant event in the Bitcoin space. Essentially, the amount of money, when the miners, who are essentially the people that authenticate the transactions on the Bitcoin network, when they do their job, when they authenticate a series of transactions, they get a reward. They get 25 Bitcoins right now, and that equates to about $13,000. So that's a good chunk of change for them. That figure, that 25 Bitcoins, is going to be cut in half. And the idea behind that is that when Bitcoin first started, they needed to essentially institute some limitations on it. Otherwise, people wouldn't treat it like a digital natural resource. So is what it, you know, a digital gold. In order to have those properties, they needed to digitally institute some of the same qualities, like the scarcity for gold. For instance, every time you mine gold, you're not mining the same amount. It gets harder and harder to mine for gold. So with that idea in place, Satoshi Nakamoto instituted a rule that every 4 years, the amount of the reward would be cut in half. And so all these people in the mining community, their revenues are going to be cut. And so my piece was really trying to analyze, what do these miners do and how do they make up that income? If they're basically being asked, hey, can you do double the work and we're going to pay you half as much? For me, that doesn't sound like a great deal. But they're coming up with really innovative ways to, A, decrease their costs, B, find new revenue models too.
And then last but not least, we're down to about 3 minutes here, Ian. The Apple Pay. Mm-hmm. Apple Pay is fascinating, isn't it? You've been on top of Apple Pay really from day one, and I think this is really where you made your mark within the fintech community, is your insight, and you did a wonderful job. And you know, Brett's had you on the show multiple times talking about that. The Apple Pay rollout has been interesting, to say the least, as we've gotten down the road with this. But you wrote a piece that, and I love the title, Apple Pay is finally, and I was probably should have done that in all caps, Apple Pay is finally offering something that both retailers and customers want. Can you summarize, please?
So I think we all know the big problem with Apple Pay and physical stores when it first rolled out. The big problem was no merchants accepted it. And if I want to pay and no one's accepting it, where am I going to pay? It's kind of a chicken and egg problem. That's a problem that really exists in the physical world. In the digital world, those kind of, you know, mundane problems are really, really easy to fix. For instance, I was looking at the Apple Pay web browser API. It's actually really easy. If I can understand it, it's really easy. So knowing that, a lot of retailers have already decided to start, announcing and, confirming that they'll be integrating Apple Pay into their web browser. According to Gene Munster, who's probably one of the best Apple analysts in the world, his report from Piper Jaffray said that 21 out of the top 100 internet retailers have confirmed that they'll be adding Apple Pay, with another 10 or 15 expected to do so by the official rollout date. That's 43% of this of PayPal's market right there in the top 100 retailers, which is a really, really big deal. It shows that this is something that retailers want to implement. They want a faster checkout method online. They wouldn't do it if they didn't think that it could get them more customers. So I think that that's what they expect too. And I think from a user experience perspective, using Apple Pay for web browser payments does seem pretty fast. I got a demo of it during WWDC, and it looked very seamless to me. And so it seems like Apple Pay is finally solving a problem, which is the real, you know, which has always been the case in online commerce. It's, you know, fast, frictionless checkout.
What's the whole chicken and egg, right? I mean, that's the analogy that constantly gets used with mobile payments. And here in the U.S., it's, you know, how do you get the retailers on board? How do you get the consumers on board? And how do you do that at the same time when you look at, you know, the success they've had in the U.K., you look at the success, you know, in other parts of the world, and then you get to the U.S., and it's just interesting. I think Jim Roos...
The chicken and egg problem online doesn't really exist.
Exactly.
You just drop in a couple lines of code, and boom, you support Apple Pay. So that's I think the ease of integration has really jump started a lot of adoption pretty early on from retailers.
Yeah, I completely agree. In app, online, that's nirvana in the digital age. Well, Ian, as always, Thank you. If you want to see Ian's writing, actually, if you just Google Ian Carr, and that's with one R, right, Ian? So I always get it
wrong.
Yeah,
one R.
Quartz has a wonderful page for Ian. You can see his writings. Follow him on Twitter. Just don't let your kids read the postings. Whatever you do. Yeah, Ian, thank you for your time. We, as always, really appreciate it.
Always happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
No problem. We're going to get ready to go to our next break. We really want to make sure we thank our gracious sponsor, Temenos. We want to also thank you for listening to Breaking Banks. You're, you know, a wonderful audience, and you're participate with us on Twitter. Definitely reach out to the Breaking Banks hashtag with any questions you might have. And we'll be right back after this short break.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Consult Hyperion is a boutique payments consultancy based in New York and London, which helps clients deal with the rapid changes happening in the payment space. We deal with EMV optimization, helping issuers, acquirers, and merchants deliver value from their EMV investments. We help with the technical challenges involved in the digital transformation of payments through tokenization and mobile devices, and with the business cases behind the development of future payment technologies such as the blockchain and instant payments. Come and find out more at www.chyp.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, everybody. This is Sam Maul. We began today's show discussing Brexit and the revolution, really, that's taking place in the UK right now. So it's only fitting that we turn our eyes toward Boston, the birthplace of the American Revolution. And our next guests are actually from Radius Bank in the Boston area. We have Mike Butler, who's the president and CEO of Radius Bank. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you? Good afternoon.
Doing well. And we have Chris Tremont, who has the title of EVP of Virtual Banking. It's a great title, Chris.
Thanks, Sam.
And on the break, we were discussing the important topics of sports because both Mike and Chris spent time in Cleveland and they let me know that they're Champion City. Good God, the world we live in today. Brexit, Cleveland winning. I really don't know what else to do with my life. Guys, if you don't mind, can you kind of take us down the story of Radius Bank? It says this is a community bank, particularly focused on the fishing industry, right? If I have this right?
No. So let me tell you a little bit about Radius Bank and where it emanated and And actually, I joined the bank in 2008, right in the middle of the financial crisis. And for all intents and purposes, the bank experienced the problems like every other community bank overexposed to real estate. And we went through a kind of turnaround situation cleanup. In the middle of that, as part of that, we set out on a strategy to take this community bank and kind of bring it into the future and kind of set a strategy that we thought would be successful for the community bank of the future. So after about 2.5 years of kind of going through the cleanup, we started to execute on our strategy, which predominantly focused on trying to deliver our retail strategy in a totally virtual way. So we committed to technology, products, services, culture, and over the years have rolled out what we think is a industry-leading retail virtual banking platform that allows our customers to do all of their banking via all of their devices. And we believe that that is a model that the customers and consumers are demanding from banks today, and we continue to commit to kind of making sure that that model moves forward with technology, and it's really been a good, great experience for us and our customers. But there's several other different ways we are a community bank, making loans and working with other small businesses across the country.
And Mike, if you could, kind of give us an idea of what your customers, that your typical customer is like. You know, what sort of market are you targeted toward?
Yeah, so you know, we're really a three-pronged strategy, right? So we have a commercial banking group, and inside that commercial banking group, we deal with commercial real estate and have a big focus on SBA lending, which is small business, and that's a nationwide platform for us. We also have a very large treasury management group where we provide fairly sophisticated treasury management services to large organizations like pension funds and municipalities. And then on the virtual side, we work with customers, frankly, who want to do business virtually. And that client segment for us is defined, you know, a little bit differently today with a kind of a psychographic that we refer to as early technology adapters. And we look at that group differently than I think traditional banks do, looking at various other segments by age or, you know, geographic location. Today, our average customer is probably in the 40-year-old range.
Yeah, high 30s.
And we have probably a strong concentration in metropolitan markets across the country.
You know, and I'm glad that you went there. I mean, somewhere not that far from you, up in New England, Ron Shevlin is high-fiving himself because the term millennial, early adopter, I don't think anything spins Mr. Shevlin up more than that. And I tend to agree with him. We tend to think that anybody who's an early adopter of technology has to be this 20-year-old hipster in Brooklyn. And Chris, I'm not calling you a 20-year-old hipster, but I have seen your picture on LinkedIn, so you're not my age. can you talk a little bit more about that customer base? Because you are the virtual banking EVP. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. And so that, to highlight Mike's point, I mean, that was sort of a conscious effort where we said we're not just going after, as you put it, Sam, the 20-year-old hipster, but it's less about age in that you could have somebody 60, 65 years old that's looking to do their banking without needing to come into a physical brick-and-mortar location. And so that's sort of what we've based our product development on, the technology rollouts, our marketing approach, our customer service approach towards sort of that client base that is looking to be able to do everything from their devices with their debit card over the phone, that doesn't need to come in and see us every day. And so that's the market we're going after. We don't specifically say it's got to carve out the 18 to 34 age demo or something like that. But it's sort of a broader approach, and it's worked out well for us.
Well, I'm going to give you guys a wonderful shout out here because you did something that when I speak to community banks and credit unions and others, that I tell them they really don't have an excuse not to be doing this, your partnerships with fintech companies and looking out, you know, outside your own walls. Because can you talk a little bit, I believe it's what, Gratify, that you've partnered with?
Yeah, and this is, I'm going to start a little bit, then Chris can get into some of the details on Gratify. But, you know, we realized early that there were a lot of companies out there able to create technology platforms, products, a better customer experience than sometimes we can inside a banking organization. And our view and culture is to find really good partners that kind of share our culture, our commitment to customer service, our commitment to security, and actually our commitment to supporting the regulatory environment, which is real to us. And we found some really good partners out there. And we also, it was clear early on that if we were going to be a leader in this industry, that we couldn't be reliant on the traditional 900-pound gorilla to deliver to us the products that we needed in the time frames we wanted them, or with the features, functionality, and or experience that we require. So we set up these kind of partnerships that go from our online banking partner in Q2, which is a much more open architecture type company than most of the banks use, to our strategic partners like Gratify. So it kind of is all throughout the organization. Sometimes it represents backroom support. Sometimes it represents, you know, kind of partnership around client acquisition. And so, Chris, why don't you talk about Gratify?
Yeah, and it really, I mean, to echo off that, started probably near the end of 2012 is when we've 3.5-4 years ago kind of started going down this path as it relates to some of the fintech partnerships that Mike was mentioning. And he sort of challenged myself and our team to kind of get outside of the box and think about ways that we can grow the bank and provide better products and services to our customers. So that's made its way from partnering with a firm here in Boston called Level Up on the mobile payment side to a digital investment firm based out of L.A. called Aspiration that we launched about 12 months ago. To our most recent announcement that we made public, a partnership with a Boston-based company here in town in Boston called Gratify, that we're really excited to roll that partnership out in the next 2 or 3 months. They're tackling obviously a big social and economic issue in terms of how Americans can pay down student loan debt faster, and so we're excited to be a part of that solution where we'll be offering a checking account product with a debit card tied to it that every time you make a swipe, it helps pay down your student loan. So that was sort of a definitely some alignment in terms of mission and what they're trying to accomplish, and we're working hard over the next couple of weeks, months, to get that live to market.
I'm a father of four, so if you don't think that yeah, thank you. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm drinking even as we speak. No, I'm not FCC, but I have four kids. It's fascinating what you suddenly become very interested in when you're in that situation. So the cost of college, the cost of weddings, you take your pick. One last question for you guys: when you take an existing company, an existing financial institution like you already had, and you go through a shift like this towards digital, towards virtual, how much does culture come into play? The reason I asked that, we had Jill Castilla on from Citizens Bank of Edmond in Oklahoma. And, you know, in the early days when she first came in and said, we're closing every branch but one, you know, she was pretty much called every name under the book by her own team and those in the community. How's that shift been for you? And how do you kind of tie that culture together for your team?
Yeah, so, I mean, I would tell you culture is everything, whether you're a branch banking organization or whether you're a virtual banking, you know, culture is what makes a company successful. And defining that culture, the discipline to it, and the commitment to it. So I would tell you since 2008, 95% of the people inside this company are brand new to the organization. And, you know, that's my job, right, to attract and motivate the right type of people who we think can be successful in this organization. we're not for everybody, and we're very open about that. We need kind of entrepreneurial bankers. We need people who are excited about the future rather than the past, who think about where we're going versus where we came, who don't have preconceived notions of how things should be, but have an open, creative thought process on how we can build an outstanding customer experience. And that's what we've done here. We have a really interesting, I would call, barbell of employees. We've got the gray hairs like me, if you were sitting in the room, and we got the cool dudes like Chris. And, you know, I made a point to go out and attract people like Chris to the organization who understood the importance of technology and the customer experience. And then with my level of experience and some of the other people, we help direct and drive Chris and all the younger guys here when it comes to making sure we do it in a long-term, sustainable, safe way. So it's been really fun. It's been great. It's a journey, and we continue to, I think, attract some really great talent to the organization, and that continues to be my number one focus.
You know, it's funny, and I've said this, I think, every time I'm on the air on this show. Yes, you know, fintech is about the technology. It's about the engagement and experience with the consumers, but at the end of the day, it always comes back to the people in the company. That's, you know, it's the number one asset you have.
And Sam, it always will, no matter what new technology you place out there. If you don't have the right people behind it, it doesn't matter how good the technology is.
Yeah, I mean, and Brett preaches that. I mean, you know, if you've listened to the show, Brett talks about the upcoming AI, you know, the robot revolution, if you will, that we're about to go down. But even in his book, he constantly makes the point, if y'all can tell I'm sucking up to Brett a little bit, but he does make this point that the future isn't about, you know, robots taking all of our jobs. It is about how well we as individuals work with robots, for example. You know, how well we are adaptive to and can work with the AI and the tools that we're using. And, you know, I applaud you guys. It's a tough shift, and it's a tough fork in the road to take. Both for your customers, you know, the community that you serve, and internally.
Yeah, we, you know, Sam, we kind of try and make it easier on ourselves and say, if we don't move forward and don't take the right fork, it's a really kind of struggle of trying to stay alive and battle the future, and we don't want to do that. And I would tell you that, you know, I know we only have a minute or so left. What we've done here has proven itself to be really successful. And, you know, on the retail side of our organization, we open 500 new checking accounts a week, and our deposits are growing over $1 million a week.
That's success.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. And guys, you were right. We only had about 30 seconds left, but thank you both so much. Take a look, folks, at Radius Bank, another great case study. And last, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Temenos. We want to thank you, the listeners, for listening to Breaking Banks. Please go to our iTunes page. Leave us a review. It really helps us out and helps even more the people behind the show and helps people find the show. Everyone, have a great week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.